For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Martin McCloskey on fire. This is Mark McCloskey on fire on Newstalk STL.
I get no doubt.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mark McCloskey, Mark McCloskey on fire, and News Talk STL 101.9, 94.1. It's on my ex, formerly known as Twitter feed. You can find me on Rumble. You can find me on Facebook, any place you get your podcast. Well, you know, if you've been alive for the last couple of weeks, you know that the United States hasn't had a Speaker of the House of Representatives since the former Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, lost his position, and there's been a lot of back and forth and a lot of candidates for it, but we now have a new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Representative Mike Johnson of Shreveport, Louisiana, and we are blessed today to have on board, as our first guest, Congressman Eric Burleson, who was one of Missouri's most conservative and staunch conservative state senators, and now the United States Representative from the 7th District. Welcome on board, Congressman.
Thank you, Mark. It's good to see you.
Well, it's good to see you, and I'm glad to see you up there in D.C. I know that you're going to do the same for our federal government that you did for the state of Missouri, and that's uphold the Constitution and individual liberty and our God-given freedoms.
Yeah, that's top priorities. And I was really glad to see that we elected somebody that has very similar values to you and I in Mike Johnson.
Tell us a little bit about the new speaker.
Well, to give you an idea, I kind of had an early glimpse of who he was because when he was, whenever I was thinking about running for office, and I was talking to some of the people up here who were trying to get me to run, I really wanted to understand what's the life of the lawmaker like. You know, having kids back home, how does that work, and how does the logistics work? So they said, you know, there's a guy from Louisiana just got elected, and he's a lot like you. His name's Mike Johnson. So here, they gave me his phone number and said, why don't you call him? He'd be willing to kind of show you the ropes and tell you how life is really going to be. And so I called him. He was very gracious. He spent a lot of time with me. And so I got to know him at that point. And he really is a very genuine servant heart type individual. He's a Christ follower. He lives it. There's a lot of people that you know are Christians but may not be living it, and as the way they treat other people. This Mike Johnson is somebody that, you know, look, the way in which the dynamic works, running for speaker this time around when you've got such a slim majority, you can't afford to have any enemies. And Mike Johnson was someone that not a single person can say a bad thing about, and that's who we have now.
And you know, and given the fact that he's a real conservative and a real constitutionalist and a supporter of President Trump and what the liberal elites would call a ultra MAGA Republican, to have no dissent in the party was really refreshing.
Yeah, to have it be unanimous. And you know, some people were saying to us during all these tumultuous times where we didn't have a speaker, Why can't all of you Republicans vote the same? Why can't you get it together, you know, vote like the Democrats do? And my response, and I said this to a group back home last weekend, when they asked me that very question, I said, let me ask you a question. Do you want your congressman, do you want me to get elected and then go hand my voting card over to the speaker? Or do you want me to be someone that thinks for myself and votes what I think is best for the district? And we should be happy that the Republican Party is not some totalitarian, top-down ruled organization. We are ruled from the bottom up, from the individual members who all have varying opinions and come from different backgrounds and different districts. And I think that that's a good thing.
Yeah. You know, and what I liked the best about Mike Johnson's acceptance speech was when he talked about how he was not going to have a monolithic Republican Party, that the speaker wasn't going to be the all-powerful and all-wise, and that they were going to distribute power amongst the members of the House. And I think that'd be a remarkable and refreshing change.
Yeah, for decades and decades, speakers have changed the rules to in order to consolidate power to the chair of the speaker and take away that power from the individual lawmakers. A lot of it was reversed whenever we voted in McCarthy, because he had to make concessions in order to become speaker. If you remember those 15 rounds, he gave up a lot of the rule changes. And as a result, we already decentralized a lot of that power. For example, for about 20 plus years, members could not make changes or drop amendments on bills that went to the floor. They couldn't make changes to bills. They couldn't make changes to appropriation bills. They really, it really was basically bills that were written by the speaker and the chairman of the committee. And that bill would then hit the floor with no one else having any input. But now we're under regular order, which means that when bills come to the floor, we have amendments. In fact, today we brought up the energy and water appropriations bill, mm-hmm. and there were a great number of amendments that were conservative amendments that conservatives were able to offer. So that's good news. The bad news is that this town is still a swamp, and there's still Republicans who sided with Democrats to vote down the amendments that had any kind of cuts in the appropriations to them. In fact, the only amendment that passed was a Democrat amendment that had an increase in a particular line item.
Yeah, that sounds just like the state of Missouri, where we allegedly have super majorities in both houses of Congress, and yet, nothing conservative actually gets passed. My recollection is that when you were a state senator, out of 34 Missouri senators, there were, 7 or 8 of you that were genuine constitutional conservatives.
Yeah. Yep. And it's pretty similar up here. But the good news is, just like in Missouri, what the conservative caucus did in the Senate especially was try to force votes on key issues and make people come out and vote against it, rather than kill it behind the scenes in a back door way where there's no fingerprints on it. Yeah. And the same way, all these amendments, all the members that are voting against a cut or voting for an increase, they now are on record, and there's a lot of votes that are occurring, and their district will at least understand where their member stands.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's the likelihood of getting something done? I know you've only got one house of Congress, and the Senate's still controlled by the Democrats, at least for the next little while. What's the chance of actually getting something done on the border, closing down the border or at least causing this government to enforce the laws that are already on the books?
That's a good question. The dynamic that we're in is that we can't just force things through the Senate and the White House. But we have to identify what the Senate or the White House want more than what we want. And that, for example, is Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Republicans in the House are hesitant mm-hmm. to add any more dollars to this Ukraine war effort. Now, the Democrats and Joe Biden, that's their number one ask. So if we're going to fix the border, we've already passed House Bill number 2, which was the border control fixing bill. Mm-hmm. Send it over to the Senate, and they didn't do anything with it. What we can do is basically require that they pass and that the president signs HR 2 before we send any more money to Ukraine.
Yeah.
We're going to have to do things like that. We're going to have to, in some ways, take a hostage in order to get something.
Yeah. Well, the House controls the money. And if you don't authorize expenditures, they can't happen. And so that ought to be a good way to hold the government's feet to the fire and say, look, if you wish to get anything done, the first thing you're going to have to do is take care of the border. I mean, I say this every week on this show, 107,000 Americans died last year from opioid overdoses, the vast majority from fentanyl that comes from China through the southern border. And yet no one is calling that the kind of crisis it was. I'm a little older than you are, Eric, but I remember distinctly the Vietnam War era. 57,000 Americans died in years of fighting in Vietnam, and everybody recognized that as a crisis, both people that thought the war was justified to limit communist expansionism and those people that were opposed to the war. But everybody recognized 57,000 Americans killed as a huge crisis. Now twice that many die every year from overdoses, and I don't hear the outrage.
Yeah, that's those numbers are really disturbing. Thank you for sharing that. You're right. We had protests. The world was in upheaval for the losses that we had, and they pale in comparison to losses that we have with this war on drugs.
Yeah. It's not a war on drugs anymore. It's a lay down and let, and so many states, and thank God we're not one of them here in Missouri, but so many states are encouraging drug abuse and giving out free crack pipes and drug use information kits.
And needles.
God, and needles. And encouraging it. At the same time, claiming we've got a war on drugs, we got a war on civilization is what we've got, unfortunately.
Yeah, it seems that people are becoming more and more corrupted as time goes on.
Yeah. Well, you know, my daughter lives in Chicago, and we met her for lunch in downtown Chicago last week. And right across the street was a Hyatt Hotel owned by, guess what, Governor Pritzker. And she was telling us where she lives up in Lincoln Park. There's homeless, illegal aliens all over the place, living in the streets, living in the government buildings. There's a Marine base somewhere right near her. She says they've taken it over, and they've just given it over to the illegal aliens. You know, and I said to her, you know, I'm looking across the street here. I don't see any illegal aliens living in Governor Pritzker's hotel. But, I mean, it's just this concept of we will ruin your life, but we as a power elite will not be touched.
Yeah, the Democrats have made a lot of really poor decisions that the American people are now waking up to, whether it was defund the police, right? And so that when they backed that issue, they saw the crime rates have gone through the roof. You know, there's Democrats here, ironically, that are being carjacked in Washington, D.C. at gunpoint.
Yeah.
And that got their attention. Suddenly, the D.C. crime bill the crime issue got corrected, and then also you've got the situation you know where they're walking back some of the decisions that they've made when it comes to fuel and the decisions on the border. You know, Joe Biden has had this open border policy and allowing anyone to come over, declaring themselves an asylum seeker, which is a brand new interpretation of that law, mm-hmm. that rule. And the backlash from New York and Chicago have caused Biden to suddenly say, okay, well, we're going to reconvene the construction of the border wall.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So they're walking back a lot of their really failed policies.
Of course it is an election season and those policies aren't very popular, but I just love it when you've got Washington D.C. and New York and Chicago now all complaining about the illegal aliens when they were the sanctuary city, angels of the world just a year ago. Tell us in just a minute or so what your goals are in this legislative session.
Well, I'm obviously going to be continue to be a staunch supporter of the Second Amendment. I co-sponsored Andrew Clyde's bill to stop the Biden administration from implementing the pistol brace ban. Mm-hmm. In addition, I personally filed a bill that's called to repeal the National Firearms Act. And then a number of other handful of bills that are low hanging fruit. For example, I'm working on a bill that from the industries that come to me when I talk to small business owners and they have a complaint about something, that's where I get the best bill ideas. So, for example, one of them, they had a group of propane guys that sell propane tanks, and they said that there's an arbitrary limit on the size of these propane tanks before they have to have basically security mechanisms around them. And that is such an arbitrary size that it does most commercial propane tanks are requiring that, even though they're not that dangerous. Mm-hmm. They're certainly not a target. And so we're looking at things like that. I'm looking at a bill related to easing the supply chain by allowing for freight to be able to have preference or eliminate the preference of passenger rail, basically Amtrak over freight rail. Right now, Amtrak can tell the freight rails to stop so that their trains can go through. Mm. And, you know, it's just kind of silly that we've given that up. It should be of the free market.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in the last minute here, Congressman, I wanted to ask you, since you know, you're a freshman up there in the deep swamp. I, go ahead.
Before I forget, my big bill that I'm dropping this week on the border is a bill that Josh Hawley is sponsoring in the Senate, and I'll be the House sponsor. And it's a bill that allows the states to take action on illegal immigrants in their states. So they can deport them. And if states like Texas want to build walls, they can do it.
Oh, that's great. You know, we had a town hall meeting here in the City of St. Louis Republican Committee last week, and Andrew Bailey was there and Jay Ashcroft, and they were both talking about the power of the government, the governor, to declare an invasion and deploy the National Guard. And I know that Greg Abbott's done that in Texas. And what are your thoughts on that? I know it's outside your bailiwick being a matter of state law, but you were in the state government for a long time.
Yeah, I think that the governor should be able to have control over their troops and be able to declare that. I'm a states' rights guy. I think that too much power has been given to the federal government, and I think more can be done at the state level.
All right. Well, in 15 minutes, Congressman, tell us what it's like moving from being a state senator to up there in the swamp and then in D.C. as a United States representative.
Well, The one of the differences is in Jeff City, we're there Monday through Thursday from January till May, and then we're constitutionally required to end legislative business by May, by the second, third week of May. I can't remember. And so, but from May until January, you can get to be a normal everyday citizen. You get to have a career outside of politics, and I think that's a good thing. I think citizen legislators is what we need. But in D.C., it's actually prohibited from having any outside work. This is a full-time gig, Monday through Thursday, pretty much every week, all year round. And so it's a definite grind. It's hard on your family. It's hard on your lifestyle. You have to plan, for example, haircuts. You know, things that you wouldn't normally have to plan around when you're only in town. You know, on a Friday through a Monday, it makes things difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. Well, we sure appreciate
your... I spend a lot of time on the airplane.
I'll bet.
Way too much time on an airplane.
Well, we sure appreciate your service, and we sure appreciate what you're doing for us. And thank you very much for being on the program today, and I hope we'll have you back.
Yep. I look forward to seeing you in person, Mark. Good to see you.
Nice seeing you again, Eric. Take care. That was Congressman Eric Burleson, freshman from the 7th District of Missouri, a super guy. He was one of the strongest conservatives in the Missouri State Senate, and he's going to do a great job for us up in D.C. We get right back. I'll do my roundup of the weekend politics.
Get more Mark McCloskey at NewstalkSTL.com. More Mark McCloskey on Fire coming up on Newstalk STL. For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on NewstalkSTL.com. Mark McCloskey, on fire. This is Mark McCloskey on fire on Newstalk STL.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Mark McCloskey on fire. You know, this is my weekly roundup of the world in politics this week. And, you know, it's been, once again, one of those things. Every time we do this, I say, well, it's been an interesting week. Well, interesting is to put it mildly. The good news is, of course, we finally have, after, 18 days, a new Speaker of the House of Representatives, Representative Mike Johnson. He's from Shreveport, Louisiana, which is a nice little town. I've got a lot of friends that live in Shreveport. In fact, I'm meeting some of them this weekend for my 41st college reunion down at SMU. But it's a beautiful little town. Mike Johnson represents everything that's great about America. He uh, uh, his his uh, He was the first member of his family to get a college degree. He gets elected to the state house in Louisiana and then United States House of Representatives. Here he is. He was born 1972, I think. Relatively young man. I think he's only been in the United States House of Representatives since 2017. And here he is now Speaker of the House of Representatives, third in line to the presidency. An amazing, amazing success story. And the good news is that he's a MAGA Republican, much to the chagrin of the left, much to the chagrin of the mainstream media. Here we've got a guy who actually supports Donald Trump unequivocally, a guy who actually is willing to challenge the 2020 election results, which, of course, these days can land your rear end in prison because you're not allowed to have political dissent in this country these days. And he's willing to stand up and say what's right. And the best thing is, I was watching his acceptance speech, if you want to call it that, and he seems to have this kind of self-disparaging, kind of gleeful personality. He's not full of himself. He's not self-important. He's not condescending. He's just like a guy that's done really well in his life, at least in the frame that he's chosen to participate in, which is politics. And he seems happy, a little self-assured, a little jovial, and not some pompous stuffed shirt. And he certainly will be a tremendous improvement over the rhino Kevin McCarthy and his horde of leftists that have been driving this country down the tubes. One of the things that I'm hoping that he's going to do, draw the line on spending. Hold the Democrats, hold the power structure, hold the globalist feet to the fire, and not allow them to have any money for anything until they do things like what? Close the border, protect the United States, stop 107,000 plus of our citizens from dying of opioid overdoses every year, the vast majority of which comes across the southern border. Hopefully he will have the guts. And by the way, he's been an opponent of the unlimited funding of the Ukraine war. And hopefully he will have the guts to stand up to the forces, almost uniform forces out there, not just the left, not just the Democrats, not just the mainstream media, but the vast majority of allegedly conservative Republicans, not to mention the allegedly conservative Republican media like Fox and Newsmax, that are all in all the time, as much as it takes for as long as it takes on Ukraine. Well, the new speaker has been vocal against the unlimited funding of the war in Ukraine. And you know what? I say this every week, but it makes a little sense to me. And that is, maybe we should pay more attention to our borders than the borders of Ukraine, and for that matter, the borders of Israel, because we have our people that are dying here. And not by, you know, human beings are human beings. If you watch television every day today, you will be told every moment that an Israeli life is worth more than a Palestinian life and worth more than an American life. They always say, well, if you take 1,400 Israelis and you multiply that by the population of Israel and divide that into the square root of the population of the United States, and you take the distance from the top of the Empire State Building to the top of the Washington Monument and then divide by the square root of your shoe size, you'll find out that it's like having 50,000 Americans killed. Well, that's nice, but a life is a life. We all get one soul. God gives us one soul and one life, and everybody's life is worth as much as everybody else's, and I'm talking about innocent civilians here. So let's say that the Israelis lost 1,400 people. That number increases every day, and of course every day we have to watch the same videotapes of bloodied kids being hauled out in Israel. Well, there are 10 times as many bloody kids that have been injured and killed in Palestine, and there will be 100 times more before this fiasco is over. And we have to remember the overwhelming majority of the people in the Gaza Strip and in the West Bank, when the war reaches there, are just innocent civilians, just people trying to make a living, just people in an occupied country trying to find a way to survive after decades of being controlled in every possible way by their occupying forces. And then by occupying forces, I mean the government of Israel. And so it's not as simple as the powers that be would want you to think. It's not like this is an innocent Israel attacking an evil empire of the citizens of Gaza. 2.2 million people live in Gaza. 2.2 million people. How many have the Israeli army already killed? How many have been bombed? How many are buried under rubble? Untold thousands, all right? And this is just the beginning. And we cannot accept genocide as a solution for anything. And you would think, as I say every week, that the Israelis might be a little sensitive to the concept of genocide. And I'm no supporter of Hamas, and I'm no supporter of Hezbollah, but I am the supporter of innocent human life. I'm just the same reason that I'm pro-life and against abortion is the same reason that I'm generally against war, because who suffers the most in war? Innocent civilians. Who suffers the most in war? The people that are on the margin of life, the people that are having a hard time making their miracle happen, the poor people, the impoverished, the people just struggling to get enough food and water, the people that have kids that they're trying to feed. Those are the people that suffer most horribly in war, not the generals, not the politicians, not the people that have houses in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, not the people that have houses in Switzerland, not the people that have vacation homes in the Caribbean, but the average hardworking, God-fearing citizens that are just trying to make a living. And that's why we have to avoid the war as much as we can and avoid expanding the war. On the other hand, all you hear on television these days, almost no matter who you listen to, is that we've got to go and attack Iran, all right? Because Iran funds Hezbollah, and therefore they have to be eliminated. I think Nikki Haley's phrase was eliminated. The government of Iran. And of course, Joe Biden, in one of his Bidenisms, has said that the goal of the United States is regime change in Russia. Take down Vladimir Putin. Of course, we don't have a plan as to what we would do if we took down Vladimir Putin. We don't have a plan what we would do if we had regime change in Iran, or if, like the all war, all the time, Lindsey Graham would say, let's go bomb their refineries. Lindsey Graham went on and said this week that the Iranians have 4 refineries. They're making their billions of dollars selling oil around the world. And all we have to do to bring those evil Iranians to their knees is to bomb their 4 refineries. All right. Well, those millions of barrels of oil go into the world economy. Those millions of barrels of oil have to be replaced or the price of oil goes up, damaging all of us. But more than that, you got to think about these things. You got to think about, in the real world, upon cold reflection, what this would all mean. If the United States goes to war, right now we're fighting a war against Russia and Ukraine. We're fighting with dollar bills and equipment, but that means we are depleting our own reserves. And you may think, if you're my age, for example, or if you've can remember back to the first Gulf War, we mobilized 500,000 people to go over to Kuwait when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. We don't have 500,000 people anymore. The United States Army isn't the army that it was during the Vietnam War. The United States Army isn't the army it was 20 years ago. Do you know how many people we have in active duty in the United States Army? 452,000 with 177,000 reservists. All right. Let's take a look at some other interesting countries like Iran that they want us to invade, Iran that they want us to eliminate. Iran's got 610,000 people in its standing army, 200,000 more than the United States, plus 350,000 in reserve, which is twice the reserve force of the United States Army. And then you think about that Sunni nation up there just above, which is called Turkey. Turkey used to be the headquarters of something called the Ottoman Empire that ruled the Middle East for centuries, but Turkey has got a well-organized military that's the same size army as the United States of America. 425,000 active members of their army, 380,000 in the reserves, twice the reserve force of the United States Army. But then let's assume that we attack Iran. And let's assume that their ally, Russia, decides to get in the mix too, which, of course, everybody knows they will if this happens. So what's the size of the Russian army compared to the United States Army? Well, the Russians have 1,100,000 men in their standing army, active duty, 2 million in their reserve forces. And guess what? What does Russia have? Russia has a friend in a country called China, the People's Republic of China. So let's look at the Chinese military. 2 million soldiers on active duty in their military, plus 500,000 in their reserves. So let's assume that we kick that hornet's nest. Let's assume that in order to preserve and to punish? I mean, exactly, exactly what is it that we're doing here on behalf of Israel. I mean, everybody calls Israel our greatest ally in the Middle East, and sure, fine, but what exactly is going on here? Israel says that it needs to destroy Hamas. That's fine. Let them do it. Israel says that they need to defend their borders and their survival. Fine. Let them do it. We have two carrier battle groups standing by right now in a place where they can be, you know, subject to, well, destruction by Exocet missiles, amongst other things. Do you remember in the Falkland Islands War, a British naval vessel was struck by one Exocet missile and sank? You will remember back in the Gulf War, we had this American ship called the USS Stark. I happened to represent back in those days a guy who was a phalanx gunner on the USS Stark. Phalanx is this computerized device which is supposed to shoot down ground-to-ground missiles like Exocet missiles that come in at low altitude and high speed. Well, the guy told me that his phalanx gun takes 20 minutes to warm up the computer. And then once it warms up, you got to make sure it's online. They had, 1 minute warning before the first Exocet hit the Stark. Blew a hole in the side of that vessel, lifted it 15 feet out of the water. My guy was horribly injured. And so you got to think about having two carrier groups there. Each carrier group has more firepower than all the sides in World War II expended during the entire course of World War II. And so we're going to have that. Do you think that might be something that could go wrong? Do you think there might be some risk of something going horribly wrong when you got two carrier groups? And now we're talking about, you know, bringing in or already having on the ground in Lebanon, for example, right now, American advisors, American special forces. I think the last report from the president under the War Powers Act said we had 89 special operatives in Lebanon working with the Lebanese army, right? And not to mention billions of dollars that we spent building up the Lebanese army. Not to mention the fact that we supported Hamas. Not to mention the fact that Hamas is the elected government of Gaza. So you don't hear all this stuff. But what are we supposed to do? We're supposed to go in there on behalf of Israel, declare war, go to war against the Lebanon and Jordan and Syria and Iran and maybe Iraq and Russia and China, at a time when we are woefully underprepared, understaffed, undermanned, and underprovisioned. You think that might turn out badly? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a break now. When I come back, we'll talk more about what a mess we're in and how we're going to hell in a handbasket.
Get more Mark McCloskey at newstalkstl.com. This is Mark McCloskey on Fire on Newstalk STL. For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com. Mark McCloskey, on fire. Notorious. You're listening to Mark McCloskey on Fire on Newstalk STL.
Well, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You know, my lovely bride, as everybody says, Patty, went to get her nails done today because we're gonna scoot out of town and we all want to look our best. I got my hair cut today, but while she was at the beauty shop, they still call them beauty shops. I don't know. I'm sure there's some fancy name for it. She got to watch for an hour today, broadcast TV. You know, I don't ever watch broadcast TV. In fact, I'm pretty much just cable news 24/7. But they have these things on cable television now and broadcast TV, which I guess are supposed to be in the form of entertainment. And there are shows where a whole bunch of just openly gay guys and hysterical, silly women bounce up and down and hug each other and scream. And there's not a genuine man, not a single masculine type person there, and not a single reasonable, level-headed type woman. You know, you've seen my wife on the front porch with a pistol. You know she's not that kind of a girl. But what they are selling to mainstream America is this is what you should be like. You should be a silly, airheaded, effeminate man talking about fashion and clothes and music and stuff like that. And you got to be a girl that giggles and bounces up and down and is completely superfluous. Or as my wife Patty said today, to call them juvenile would be too much of a compliment. And when we're facing a world of potential horrors, when we're facing a world where the future may be of a kind that we're unprepared to handle, General Flynn said last week on his X feed that what's coming down the pike here may be worse than any American alive can remember or even imagine. And I'm not sure that he's wrong on that. But if you're training the youth of this country to be silly, superfluous, effeminate weaklings that are offended by everything, then we're not going to do too well in a time of absolute crisis. I mean, a year ago and a couple of days, there was a shooting at a school in St. Louis. One student got killed, one teacher got killed. They brought in grief counselors for weeks. They took the day off school this year on the anniversary so that people could mourn. Well, this is a school in the city of St. Louis where these same kids that need grief counseling because a year ago one of their classmates got shot and a teacher got shot, they go home every day to a neighborhood where people are dying like flies. I mean, they go home to a neighborhood where gunfire is the most common sound you hear. I live on the edge of the ghetto in St. Louis. We hear the gunfire every night. We heard, you know, we were getting ready for bed the other night, and we heard all these, you know, pop, 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 and went on for a long time. And Patty and I were looking out the window. Sometimes it's fireworks, and you can see them, but it didn't sound like fireworks, and you couldn't see any flashes of light. And we're saying to each other, if that's a gun battle, which it sure sounds like, it's a huge gun battle. I mean, it went on for 10 minutes and more rounds than I could count. But that's life in St. Louis. But then they teach these kids that what you got to do is you got to mourn. You got to be sad. You got to have grief counseling. You got to throw your hands up and scream and wail. And yet, in the real world, it's a pretty gosh darn tough place out there. And you got to harden up. You got to man up. You got to take personal responsibility for your own emotions, because when the fit hits the shan, you're not going to want to have to sit there and wail and throw your arms around and cry. You want to be able to take action. You want to be able to support yourself. You want to be able to find something to eat, find something to drink, find some way of helping those people that can't, and pulling yourself together. And the last thing you need to do is grow up in an environment where you're encouraged to be a weakling, encouraged to be a victim, encouraged to have mental disorders, encouraged to have a need for Ritalin or a need for Xanax or a need for Ativan or a need for all kinds of pharmaceuticals to treat your fictitious mental illness, which is just an excuse for not manning up and being tough. And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to be tough, because we're going to face enormously tough times. So let's talk about something else that's got me a little concerned right now. You know, when you're on the Trump campaign, we would get daily briefings. And one of the people that would give us daily briefings was a young lady named Jenna Ellis. Well, what happened to Jenna Ellis this week? Jenna Ellis pled guilty down in Fulton County, Georgia, in that completely bogus lawsuit or criminal action filed by the DA, a state court local county district attorney, Fannie Willis, against Donald Trump and 18 others. Well, so far, four of those 18 others have pled guilty. A guy who a bail bondsman named Scott Hall, who I don't know from Adam, Kenneth Cheesebro, who is one of Trump's lawyers, Sidney Powell, who is one of Trump's chief lawyers and one of the strongest advocates, and Jenna Ellis, one of those people that used to give us daily briefings when we were on the Trump campaign. And here's Jenna Ellis reading her confession, reading her apology to the world for having supported Donald Trump, and crying the entire time. You know, my wife thinks Donald Trump is her son, that he can do absolutely no wrong and that everything he does is perfect. And as you know, I'm a pretty gosh darn strong Donald Trump supporter. But I would tell you one thing that I think he lacks or lacked in the first campaign and in his first presidency, and that's a good judge of human character. Here's a guy that employed a lawyer named Michael Cohen. I mean, you take one look at Mr. Cohen, you know he's not going to be a reliable anything. You wouldn't send him out for sandwiches. Then you got Jenna Ellis. I mean, shoot, what kind of a person cries for 20 minutes while confessing to a misdemeanor? What kind of a person would, you know, there used to be this thing called integrity. It used to be this thing that you would stand up, and even if it cost you personally, you would support your cause, support your president, support the people that you worked for, support the people that you believed in, and even if you had to go and cool your rear end in jail for a few years to support something you really believed in, you would do it because the principle was more important. The country is more important than you as an individual. And then you got all these people who are just bailing on President Trump and wanting to throw him under the bus. I couldn't have been more disappointed in Jenna Ellis than to see her crying on camera while confessing to things which weren't crimes, confessing to things that she didn't do just because she's afraid of having to spend some time in the slammer. Well, you know, I hate to use this as a reference, but for those out there that ever watch The Sopranos or any of these other TV shows, you know, when somebody rats out, there's nothing more despised than somebody that will turn state's evidence. And this is ridiculous because these charges brought in Fulton County, Georgia, are pure fiction. They're not crimes. They're what every losing politician has done, or a person who believes that they have not legitimately lost has done, including, for example, well, let's see, Hillary Clinton, who still believes she beat Donald Trump and still says it every day. Stacey Abrams, who still claims that she's the governor of that very same state of Georgia, where they're now trying to convict Donald Trump for disputing the election results, even though she disputes them for till today. But you got these people pleading guilty and agreeing to testify against Donald Trump in this completely bogus nonsense down in Fulton County. But you know the refreshing thing? I saw that the Sidney Powell, who is going to unleash the Kraken, is still out there saying the same thing she did before she pled guilty, that there was election fraud, that the election was stolen, that Donald Trump really got elected president of the United States. And so, you know, maybe these people aren't really going to roll on the president and make up stuff to try to get him convicted just to save their own asses. But you never know. One of the most distressing things that I saw was when Jack Smith, the federal prosecutor that's trying to barbecue Donald Trump in New York, gave Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, immunity. And you got to wonder what's going to happen there. I have no idea. I had a great deal of respect for Mark Meadows. Mark played a significant role in saving our rear ends on July the 3rd of 2020 when the mob came back the second time. And I don't believe that he's going to roll on the president. And by the way, what he said about January 6th and the aftermath in his own book just recently published contradicts everything that the mainstream media is saying he's going to testify to. So all this, you know, who knows how all this is going to turn out. But think about this. Think about the prospect. I think Trump's trial down in Georgia is supposed to take place on March the 4th of 2024. Well, the election is in November of 2024. Donald Trump couldn't get a fair election, couldn't get a fair trial in Fulton County, Georgia, no matter what. They could accuse him. They could recommend life sentence for jaywalking, and the jury would give it to him because that's just the way it is there. There's no longer anything like equal justice under the law or a fair justice system or fair juries or fair prosecutors in jurisdictions. They pick the jurisdictions where the prosecutor hates Donald Trump and the jury hates Donald Trump because they know they can't lose there. Well, can you imagine what will happen if they convict Donald Trump down in Fulton County, Georgia? Fannie Willis and the assistant prosecutors and all these people, they'll be out there at their favorite drinking hole in the middle of, as soon as a verdict comes in, they'll be drinking their Courvoisier and smoking their cigars and laughing their asses off because they ran for office on the promise that they were going to get Donald Trump. And how that isn't bias and how that isn't prejudice that would keep them from staying on the case the same way my wife and I were able to get Kim Gardner tossed off of our case for bias and prejudice. I don't understand it. But you imagine Donald Trump having to run for president from a jail cell? Do you imagine the Secret Service cells that they'd have to have available so that all his Secret Service agents could be in jail with him? You know, this is so bizarre. You could not possibly have made this up. If you're gonna propose this as a book synopsis or a movie script 10 years ago, everybody would say it is so ludicrous, it couldn't possibly happen. But here it is unfolding before our eyes. The government has ceased to exist as a representative form of government. We now live in a police state where if you don't toe the party line, you get arrested, you get persecuted, and you'll get convicted. And by the way, if you ever want any more proof of that, just look at the January 6th defendants who are getting decades, even people that weren't even in D.C. on January 6th, decades in federal prison, as opposed to if you do something simple like murdering people, you might get 7 years. So, you know, it has become a situation which is completely untenable. You know, I start every speech I give these days with this question. Whether it's 20 people in the audience or 500, I say, how many of us here in this room think that there is a political solution to our current problems? And you know, in the last 22 times I've given that speech, not a single hand has gone up. And ladies and gentlemen, when the population of this country has so little faith in the elective process, so little faith in our elected representatives, so little faith in the criminal who is running our country and thrusting us into a war which will cost the lives of millions, if they have so little faith in that they do not believe that politics can solve our problems, then, ladies and gentlemen, we have a huge problem indeed.
Get more Mark McCloskey at NewstalkSTL.com. This is Mark McCloskey on Fire on Newstalk STL. For podcast articles and more, find us on NewstalkSTL.com.